Thank you for enriching our discussion. So in keeping with the principle that the only thing standing between you and lunch is us, we're going to keep the questions from the floor short and the answers from the panel relatively short. I'm interested in a question about the participation in international global collaborative projects from countries in the developing world, and how difficult is it to persuade policymakers that they need to participate, including contributing resources, as opposed to just sitting back and waiting for the results of the work. You know, there's a benefit that we at least argue to our policymakers from participating as opposed to just receiving the outcome of the projects. But how difficult is that in those countries where scientific capacity is just being developed and very expensive? So does anybody have any experience with that or thoughts? That's it. Yeah, please, somebody.
Just thank you. It's interesting with the START program that Mohammed Hassan and I have been involved in, and others in the room, is that we've tried not only to, let's say, support research, but we've tried to build the connection with the policymakers through a kind of iterative process of involving basically science policy workshops, where we get the young scientists, where we tell them we're training you how to talk to a policymaker, and we're telling the policymaker who sits at the table that we want you to hear about the science. But by having them talk to one another, we are hoping, and we think we've been somewhat successful, in enhancing the, let's say, the knowledge and understanding of how important it is to be not just receiving the information, but having their scientific community participate in it. And I guess I just make an offhand comment that, it's not, in my opinion, it's not a difference so much between developing countries and developed countries. It's more an attitude of governments that happen to be in place, and these evolve with time. At least that's my impression.
We can tell you from our experience about the variation in governments.
I was going to avoid being parochial, but yeah.
Thank you very much. I'll avoid it as well. Anybody else want to make a comment or ask each other a question on the panel before we open it up to the floor? Okay, have at us. You're in charge of the microphone. Let's start with Dr. Hassan.
Thank you very much. I'm Mohammed Hassan. I'm the co-chair of IAP, the Global Network of Science Academies. Very much related to what you just asked, Alan. I would like just to focus on Iran, because I think it's a very interesting case. Iran, as we all know, is doing very well in science and technology, especially in publications. It is the second most productive country in the entire Muslim world, after Turkey. But my question really relates to sanctions and the difficulties and the impact of sanctions on the scientific productivity in Iran. How much has this really affected the scientists and the scientific communities in producing science, and especially when it comes to importing equipment for laboratories and so on. Knowing that Iran is now doing extremely well in nanoscience, nanotechnology, cutting-edge science, despite all these sanctions. And then the second question related to that is about the co-authorships. Do you know the percentage of papers published by Iranian scientists together with authors from outside Iran? How much percent is that related to the entire productivity of Iran? Because I know that the United States, for example, scientists reach out to Iranian scientists and they publish joint papers. And I think this is an interesting challenge also for us.
Thank you, Dr. Hassan. You know, about the sanctions, it's not like we say, when the sanctions comes to one issue, it's not the system that you think that you can just exclude that. The sanctions in Iran was It's about 40 years that we are in sanctions. And we learned to be innovative. About 20, 25 years ago, the percentage of the oil in our income and in our budget was more than 80%. Now it is less than 18. This is for the sanctions, because we learn to do something else. We learn to make money from other sources. Other sources that if we were not in the sanction, I think we will not go to the knowledge-based economy. We will have our resource-based economy. We are the first hydrocarbon reservoir of the world. But now we discard it. We are thinking about the new ways for the knowledge-based economy and something like that. So in these years, we have many problems. And we learn to build our products domestically. Of course, it's not efficient. It's not efficient work. You must pay more money. You have not the best quality, something like that. But you learn to do that. For example, we have about 11,000 students in the United States. More than 80% of them are engineers. We are the fifth country in the world in engineering graduates. The engineering graduates in Iran is equal to United States in the numbers. So we learn much about the sanctions, with the sanctions, and I think after these sanctions lifted up, we will grow very fast in these sections. We have many Iranians in outside of Iran. In all of the American companies, we have Iranians. So all of these Iranian elites are a potential for any cooperation in the future of Iran. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I can't, oh, in the back, I'm sorry. And then we'll come back here.
Thank you very much, Alan. My name is Virginia Murray. I'm from Public Health England, but I'm also the Vice Chair of the United Nations International Strategy on Disaster Reduction Scientific and Technical Advisory Group. Say that in a hurry. The main message that I would like to share is that Gordon was very holistic in his approach. He reflected that the challenges in global cooperation, practices, and pitfalls, covering not only the climate change and sustainability agreements of 2015, but most importantly for us, the disaster risk reduction. If we do not deal with disasters more effectively, we will not be able to do sustainability better, and we will hold that back in the development for the future. But also, we will not implement a lot of the climate change agreements if we are stuck in the world of one disaster after another. Janos, in your presentation, you talked mostly about sustainability and climate change. But I was really concerned that you did not state that the Sendai framework is written by the UN member states. It's not written by scientists. And the UN member states ask for the science this time. And the science is really descriptive. Isn't this an opportunity for a real global call for scientists to respond to what the member states need, not just in sustainability, not just in climate change, but also let's get to the root cause, disasters? Thank you.
Thank you. I think your point is an incredibly important one. Anybody want to respond to it?
Just very quickly. I mean, I totally agree with you. I did not list a number of, for me, the whole disaster risk reduction agenda is totally part of the sustainable development agenda, just like climate change. It has to be. And if we can, you're totally right, if we cannot fix the disaster issues, then we will not be able to fix other problems. So absolutely in agreement.
I myself agree that preparedness and response are critically important. Risk anticipation as much as we can. Maybe not for discussion now, but something we should be thinking about is how detailed is the response plan, the action plan for achieving the SDGs, the articulation of them, I get. But I don't know how specific and how detailed the plans are for, in fact, achieving those goals.
Just to comment on following Virginia's comment, that I can't respond to your question on the SDGs. I don't think we're there yet. But in the case of the disaster risk reduction part, we had the, first of all, the meeting in Kobe, or the Hyogo Framework for Action in 2005, and then this year, the Sendai Framework for Action, which laid out a set of things and goals like the SDGs does. But we will have a meeting in January in Geneva, UNISDR, meeting where which the intention, the objective, is to have that set of framework of action, sets of activities, really commitments to do things that will address the targets and objectives under the framework convention, sorry, the framework agreement on disaster risk reduction. And I think it's a model that could be followed in the SDG approach. It's somewhat followed in the climate change approach already, or we're following them, whichever you wish.
I think the terrible difficulties in dealing with Ebola emphasize the point to make the definition of disaster as broad as we can.
Yes.
Just very briefly on the SDGs, your question and I agree, it's a bit too early in many cases, but just 2 points about it. One is that the SDGs were developed in a bottom-up process by governments in a way that is quite interesting and quite unique. It actually shows what they want to do, which is very different than what we had with the MDGs, which was cooked up by three people in the Secretary General's office, and it took 3 years for the governments to actually say, oh, this is important and we want to do it. So that's very important. The second is that there are countries that are already implementing the SDGs because they saw it coming. I was in Peru earlier this month, and it's fantastic what that country is already doing.
Great.
Thank you.
That's terrific. Okay, there, please. You've been waiting patiently.
Thank you very much. My name is Yossi Korazin Kuroshi. I am a professor of social work here in Hungary and in Israel. I was born in Hungary. My question to this team is about the main concept of this session, and it is about collaboration. And you mentioned several times that you are dealing with interdisciplinary, interorganizational, and intersectorial collaborations. My question is, where do your students learn how to create effective collaborations? This is an area of my expertise in social sciences, not in nuclear sciences, unfortunately. But I do believe that there are similarities, and we should collaborate much more than we do these days. My experience is that universities still try to maintain the very old structures, academic structures, which are these top-down, closed departments, and they do not collaborate enough among themselves. I would love to hear your experience in this area. Thank you very much.
I'll just personally make a quick comment. Some of you are probably aware that one of my platforms is to rethink the way in which we do graduate education in science, and a core point is that we need to teach young scientists how to become global scientists, because they won't have an option later. But please, Gordon.
Well, just very quickly, I was going to say this, but I was running out of time. Under our Future Earth program, Research for Global Sustainability, which by necessity must be multidisciplinary across all things, we asked the science planning team, which included social scientists, what are the biggest obstacles to achieving this? And interestingly, the two of the they listed right at the beginning was the traditional structure of universities and the traditional structures of our honor systems. And we could also throw in the traditional structure in most countries of the funding councils, which are very disciplinary orientated on a traditional basis. And, you know, anyway, I don't need to elaborate. I think you know what I'm talking about. And I think this is an issue which we must collectively, through our academies, our organizations like this meeting, the World Science Forums, the Science and Technology Society Forum, Mr. Omi is back there, to address these issues in an open way so we start breaking down these barriers between the various disciplines, the various fundings, the various ways in which we honor people, which are very traditionally based. Thank you.
Okay. Is there someone in the back? I'm having trouble seeing with the bright
lights. That's Gordon Dalton from the International Consortium of Research Staff Associations. On the theme of collaboration, a question for Gordon McBean. This young scientist speaker stated that three very interesting associations are attending, the Global Young Academy, ICORSA, which I'm representing, and WAYS. Our associations are constantly seeking for recognition, and particularly ICORSA and WAYS are still young and seeking links. And I was wondering if you could think about how could ICSU and UNESCO or United Nations use our associations, collaborate with us, and to fulfill your missions and goals for global collaboration. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody want to make a comment?
Well, he seemed to be asking it to me because he said ICSU. So.
Mike, you're on, kid.
I'll just say very quickly that, of course, I did speak to the Global Young Academy. I was invited, and I really enjoyed to be a participant in their General Assembly, which happened to be held in Montebello, Quebec, last spring. But what we have done in the International Council for Science is we have, first of all, at our last General Assembly, we had a whole session on early career scientists, how do we better involve them, and the Executive Board, which I chair, at its last meeting, passed a resolution that says whenever we are setting up a committee, working group, program, etc., it will have, as it always has to have had, balance in gender, discipline, geography, but now a significant number, no fixed percentage, but of early career scientists need to be involved. Otherwise, as an executive board, we will ask them to go back and start over again. So we're trying proactively to involve young scientists, and we want to get them involved in our committees, our programs, more fully than they are now, in a way that will, I think, globally enhance the way in which they're participating. But we'll try that way. We're open to other suggestions. Thank you.
Great. Please.
Following up on that, perhaps Peter McGrath from the IAP in Trieste in Italy. I wonder if I can be very deliberately provocative, and I see that the panel here is, let's say, quite homogenous, except for Idis at the end, who joined in the last few minutes. And I wonder if these issues you just sort of spoke about were taken into account, and not just this panel, but many other international science meetings and so on. I did hear a story of, I think it was a mathematician one time who refused to be on the panel because it was so homogenous, and if more people took a stand like that, I think we could really progress on our diversity.
Well, thank you for your comment. I will say I did notice that many of the people who have been speaking over the course of the last few days have blonde hair, as I do. So I do think there's a core point that I would just repeat, and that is that we should make sure that younger scientists are brought in as active participants, not just attendees, because first of all, we benefit greatly from their ideas and their novel views, but in addition to that, it helps train the next generation of uses. So we have about 1 minute. I'm going to ask the panelists if they have any concluding comments they'd like to make. I think it's been a wonderful conversation. I want to thank the panel.
Good night, everybody. Thank you.
And the questions have been quite good and quite provocative, so thank you very much. And with that, let them have lunch. Thank you.
Perfect.